Part 2. Design. Part 2 explains the scientific basis of soldier performance and how the H2F training program is designed. Training approaches described in Part 2 address the why of H2F, the science and rationale behind the program. The principles discussed in Part 2 form the approaches used in Part 3 to build H2F program content for individual soldiers and collective unit readiness and deployability. Chapter 4. Physiology. The effectiveness of soldiers depends largely on their physical condition. Combat places a premium on the soldier's strength, endurance, and lethality. Victory depends on these physical attributes. Leaders also recognize that the mind controls the body. Therefore, to persevere in battle and thrive afterward requires an equal measure of psychological health, mental toughness, stamina, emotional fortitude, intellect, judgment, strength of character, and spirituality. The requirement to train all these domains, physical readiness, nutritional readiness, mental readiness, spiritual readiness, and sleep readiness, has become more urgent. The inputs that soldiers and units will be required to process and the time to process and act upon them will be inversely proportional. Therefore, the capacity of the unit to be successful rests upon every soldier's ability to respond effectively in the absence of complete information or on short notice. Collective capacity depends on this individual ability. Underpinning all is an understanding of how the human body works, its anatomy and physiology. Soldier physiology. Physiology is the study of the functions and parts of a living organism. This section describes the physiological and anatomical foundation of soldier performance. When the predecessor to the ACFT, the three-event Army Physical Fitness Test, known as the APFT, was developed in the midst of the Cold War, some senior Army leaders felt ground combat was no longer a force imperative. As a result, the Army replaced rigorous physical training and assessment linked to the performance of occupational warfighter tasks with more general fitness training and assessments. This approach mirrored civilian trends with aerobics and jogging, driving the popularity of endurance-centric fitness. The three-event Army Physical Fitness Test, along with the Army Weight Control Program, were developed to ensure a high level of health-related fitness and appropriate body mass. The lessons learned over three decades of combat operations renewed the Army's focus on the strength and power requirements for ground combat. In 2013, under HQDA directions, the Army began two major physical fitness assessment studies. One, Army-required actions in support of the elimination of the Direct Ground Combat Assignment Rule, DAGCAR, and two, comprehensive study to determine baseline soldier physical readiness requirements and a standardized baseline physical readiness test. The United States Army Research Institute of Environmental Medicine, USAREM, conducted extensive physical demand studies to determine the reliability of simulated physical soldiering tasks relevant to combat arms soldiers. The studies demonstrated that muscular strength and power drove 60% of the variability in physical demands. In other words, endurance-centric approaches to training and testing did not support all of the baseline requirements of being a soldier. As part of the analysis, USAREM identified five domains of combat physical fitness: muscular strength, muscular endurance, aerobic endurance, explosive power, and anaerobic endurance. These five domains were independently confirmed in the physical fitness assessment studies conducted by the U.S. Army CIMT. The Army Physical Fitness Test assessed only two of the five domains of combat physical fitness, aerobic endurance, and muscular endurance. The second objective of the physical fitness assessment studies was to determine common field expedient physical fitness test events that predicted a soldier's success on the high physical demand warrior tasks and battle drills, WTBD. After surveying MOS schools and several thousand combat veterans on the physical demands of soldiering, 1,000 soldiers performed WTBD simulations. Their performance validated the selection of the six events that became the ACFT. Energy pathway. Energy to move the human skeleton derives from a series of chemical and biological reactions that involve the respiratory system, lungs, cardiovascular system, heart, blood vessels, and blood, the neuromuscular system, nerve and muscle system, and the neuroendocrine system, nerve and hormone system. Energy is produced through three pathways, phosphagen, glycolytic, and oxidative phosphorylation, that convert calories into energy. The body can use the resulting energy later in physiological processes, including but not limited to movement. The onset of exercise activates all three pathways, with each one predominating after different durations and levels of effort. Energy is produced in the form of a chemical called adenosine triphosphate. Adenosine triphosphate is a large molecule comprised of adenosine and three phosphate groups. When this molecule is broken down by chemical reactions in the muscle, the energy released by this reaction is used for movement. Phosphagen pathway. In the phosphagen pathway, adenosine triphosphate stored in the muscle and another molecule called phosphocreatine provide the energy for the very short duration, 5 to 10 seconds, high intensity or high power activities. These might include 3 to 5 second sprints, the seated or standing power throw, or maximum repetition lifts. This type of training rapidly depletes energy available in the muscle cells that require long rest periods to re-energize. If soldiers do not rest enough or are forced to keep going at this level of intensity, the loss of adenosine triphosphate causes degraded performance. Depletion of the phosphagen pathway will force the use of other energy pathways, and those pathways will begin to predominate. Rest intervals between bouts of high-intensity exercises should be 2 to 5 minutes to support molecule restoration. Glycolytic pathway. The glycolytic pathway is the predominant source of energy for high-intensity exercise lasting up to 90 seconds. As its name suggests, this pathway breaks down glucose, sugar, in the blood, and glycogen, sugar deposit, stored in the muscle cells. The chemical reactions in this system happen without the need for oxygen, anaerobic reactions. These reactions produce pyruvate or lactate, depending on exercise intensity. Pyruvate is a component in the release of stored energy. Lactate is a source of stored energy that can be converted back into glucose or glycogen during exercise. The lactate threshold is the point at which lactate production exceeds its clearance from or utilization by the muscle. Soldiers who are more fit have higher lactate thresholds. Across the training period, multiple sets of heavy lifts, climbing drills, the strength training circuit, and sprint intervals result in greater overload of the glycolytic pathway and a higher lactate threshold. Precise measurement of this threshold occurs with an exercise stress test in a laboratory. Oxidative phosphorylation. This pathway is the predominant source of energy for low-intensity sustained exercise lasting for more than 3 minutes. This pathway supports aerobic performance. The presence of oxygen allows pyruvate in the muscle cell to be converted into much more adenosine triphosphate than the other two energy systems. Both fat and carbohydrate are converted into energy in this system. The process for fat metabolism is called beta-oxidation. Leaders typically use prolonged low-intensity training, such as foot marches, release runs, and ability group runs, to increase aerobic endurance. This type of training encourages the metabolism of fat for fuel. Its use of training uses much shorter rest intervals than the phosphagen pathway. Rests of as little as 5 to 10 seconds are common during low-intensity intervals. Carbohydrates, the body's main fuel source, are broken down into glucose and stored as glycogen. Glycogen stores supply about 3,000 kcal in the typical soldier and are rapidly depleted as exercise intensity increases. Soldiers may burn 1 to 3 grams of glycogen per minute during exercise, and most will run out of glycogen after 1.5 to 2 hours of activity. When glycogen stores are depleted, it results in the condition sometimes called hitting the wall. Soldiers must pay careful attention to nutrition before and during prolonged aerobic activity. For example, to avoid degrading their performance on the 2-mile run event, soldiers avoid depleting glycogen caused by the anaerobic effort of the sprint drag carry. VO2 max. The highest amount of oxygen that can be used during maximal aerobic effort, endurance training, is called the maximal oxygen consumption, or VO2 max. It is measured as volume, V, in milliliters of oxygen, O2, consumed per kilogram of body weight per minute, abbreviated to ml/kg/min. A recruit who scores black on the OPAT has a predicted VO2 max of 33 ml/kg/min. Over time and with progressive training, that recruit could improve his or her maximal aerobic capacity. Strength training typically results in little or no change in VO2 max, unless the soldier uses longer sessions of circuit-type strength training with shorter rest intervals between exercises. Strength training improves physical performance by increasing relative work capacity through increases in muscle mass and the improved strength of support structures. Strength training, coupled with circuit training, directly increases muscular strength and power, while supporting the further development of aerobic endurance, anaerobic speed, and muscular endurance. Anatomy. Anatomy refers to the physical structure of the body. Understanding the bones, muscles, and different systems that form the body helps soldiers and leaders build better training programs that improve performance while preventing injuries. Bone. The 206 bones in the human skeleton form both a chassis for muscles to attach to and enclosures to protect vital structures such as the brain, heart, and spinal cord. Bones store deposits of minerals, such as calcium and phosphorus. Although bones vary in size and shape, some typical features compose a bone's function and bone injury. The outer hard surface of the bone is the cortex. This strong and stiff tissue is lined by a fibrous layer called periosteum around the bone. The periosteum conveys blood vessels and nerves to the bone and signals pain when bumped or irritated and excruciating pain when fractured. The softer inner tissue of the bone is the marrow. Bone marrow generates red and white blood cells and platelets. Wherever two bones meet to form a movable joint in the body, an articulation, the contact surface of the bone is covered in cartilage. Cartilage is a softer, more fibrous material than the bone cortex and is made of cells that produce collagen. Its purpose is to cushion the bones, especially in weight-bearing joints like the hip, knee, and ankle, and to allow the bones to move more smoothly against each other. Cartilage does not have nerve supply, nor as many blood vessels as the rest of the bone. Once it is damaged, it does not repair well. This can lead to pain and inflammation in the joint, otherwise known as arthritis. Bones are living tissue. They grow larger and longer up to adulthood. Throughout adulthood, bones remodel when physical activity stimulates the bone to thicken and strengthen. In response to physical stress, cells called osteoblasts lay down new bone tissue to strengthen the bone, while other cells called osteoclasts reabsorb bone tissue. So long as these two processes are in balance, bone continues to strengthen and remain healthy. Poor nutrition and excessive physical training can overwhelm the remodeling process and lead to bone stress injury. Although bone stress injury is less disabling than a traumatic fracture, bone stress injury is an avoidable misuse injury, often characterized by pain. Doctors treat these injuries with modified physical activity, rest, and adequate and appropriate nutrition. They occur most often in the metatarsal, tibia, femur, and ilium, pelvic bones. Occurring more often in soldiers in the initial phase of training, bone stress injury resolves as the remodeling process catches up with bone absorption. In some cases, stress injury can progress to a fracture, such as a tibial stress fracture. Certain types of stress fractures, particularly to the neck of the femur, can be medical emergencies with disabling consequences if not immediately stabilized with surgery. Muscle. When muscles contract, they pull on bones and cause movement around joints. For example, a biceps muscle contraction repositions the forearm toward the shoulder as the forearm hinges around the elbow joint as a bicep curl. The resulting force is called torque. When the whole body moves across a marching surface, torque is created around the point where the foot meets the ground. So long as the body keeps being repositioned successfully, it will continue to move. If muscles fail to reposition the body's segments, the body will lose balance and fall. The body will not move efficiently in the desired direction, and it will eventually fatigue or become injured, either by misuse or by traumatic contact with the ground or another object. Purposeful movement is a function of repeated coordination of forces generated within the body with forces outside the body, intrinsic and extrinsic forces. Practice and coaching builds perception of how to better perform basic movements, and subsequently assists with progression to more advanced movements. Muscle fiber. In contrast to the spherical shape of other cells in the body, a muscle cell, or fiber, is a relatively long, cylindrical, microscopic structure. Muscle fibers are packed together in progressively larger groups called muscle fascicles that form the whole muscle. Muscles have different roles. Some muscles stabilize body segments, others create large limb movements, and some create small movements of the hands and fingers. These small movements are referred to as fine motor control. The function of the muscle will be driven by the fiber type. There are three muscle fiber types. Type 1. Muscle contractions during low-intensity endurance efforts are mainly assigned to type 1, or slow oxidative, known as SO, fibers. These fibers are smaller, with more mitochondria, parts of the cell that assist with energy production, and capillaries, blood vessels, surrounding them, to deliver more oxygen to the fiber. Type 1 fibers are more resistant to fatigue than the others, but type 1 fibers have a slower contractile speed and generate less force. Type 2A. During moderate intensity effort, such as 1-mile runs, type 2A, or fast oxidative glycolytic, known as FOG fibers, are the main determinants of performance. These fibers' size, contractile ability, and resistance to fatigue make them the main ones soldiers should target in their training. Training to build muscle size, hypertrophy, and strength, or using moderate to moderate hard intensity, RPE 8 out of 10 when performing endurance training, recruits more type 2A fibers. This type of training also encourages the conversion of type 2X fibers to type 2A. Type 2X. During brief maximal intensity bouts of exercise, RPE 10 out of 10, type 2X, or as fast glycolytic, known as FG fibers, are recruited. These larger muscle fibers with fast contractile speeds depend on glycogen and have poor resistance to fatigue. Once type 2X fibers are recruited, lactate can no longer be cleared from the blood, and the lactate threshold is reached. Muscle strengthening. Heavy resistance training is included in physical readiness training so that a soldier is ready to perform baseline occupational tasks. This type of training prepares soldiers for the unplanned extreme load and intensity tasks that he or she might encounter in training, deployment, or everyday life, such as responding to a motor vehicle accident or moving furniture. A specific real-life example is the case of Army medics at the Pentagon, who had no notice of the physical and non-physical demands that would be placed on them on September 11, 2001. Physical readiness training that stimulates type 2 fiber development is necessary for the strength and power development that supports anaerobic tasks, such as heavy lifting, heavy load carriage, fast sprints under load, and casualty extraction. Low-load resistance training using body weight across relatively long periods with high repetitions will not permit this type of muscle fiber development. In fact, strength training begins with a measurement of one repetition maximum, the maximum amount of weight that a soldier can lift, squat, pull, or push one time. Therefore, soldiers must train and be tested with weighted resistance above their own body weight. Once soldiers develop new strength, they must sustain it with consistent, repeated exposure to the same or progressive levels of resistance. In some cases, detraining of maximal strength can occur after a 3 to 4 week pause in training. The development of strength training flows from the one repetition maximum measure. As the one repetition maximum increases over the duration of the soldier's career, so will the weight. If the goal of a set is 6 repetitions and the soldier completes 12, the weight should be increased until no more than 6 repetitions can be completed in one set. To reduce the amount of trial and error required to hit these targets, the repetition maximum formula for calculating one repetition maximum can be used. One repetition maximum equals 0.033 times repetitions times weight lifted plus weight lifted. Using the repetition maximum formula, if the 3 repetition maximum was 100 pounds, then the 1 repetition maximum would be 110 pounds. The 3 repetition maximum is 90% of the 1 repetition maximum. As the soldier's 1 repetition maximum improves, then the 3 repetition maximum increases. A new 1 repetition maximum of 150 pounds would translate to a 3 repetition maximum of 135 pounds. If the soldier was able to deadlift 250 pounds 5 times in one set, then the 1 repetition maximum would be 291 pounds. When preparing to engage in high physical demand tasks, HPDTs, soldiers must understand the difference between absolute and relative workloads. An absolute workload is the work required to complete a physical task. For example, to perform a casualty evacuation or to lift a 95-pound artillery shell into a rack requires a specific and measurable amount of strength. A long-distance foot movement with a 100-pound ruck requires a fixed amount of endurance as well as the muscular strength to carry the load. These tasks represent absolute workloads. Higher absolute workloads require higher physiological capacity. In establishing training goals, an individual must know his or her physiological capabilities and the absolute workload of the task. The goal should be to increase the rate-limiting physiological capacities, for example, strength, speed, and endurance, to be able to accomplish higher absolute workloads. The second aspect of physical work is the relative workload. The relative workload compares a given task or absolute workload to an individual's maximal physiological capacity. In other words, relative to the maximum amount an individual could do, how much of that individual's potential is needed? Relative workload is defined as percent of maximum. It is a way to calculate the strain on the physiological systems. If an individual needs to lift a 100-pound object and his or her maximal strength or lifting capacity is 200 pounds, the relative workload for this task would equal 50%. If performing a foot march with a loaded pack requires an oxygen consumption of 2 liters per minute and the individual's VO2 max is 3 liters per minute, the relative workload would equal 66%. Therefore, improving absolute workload lowers the relative workload for fixed demand tasks and reduces the risk of injury. Musculoskeletal injuries are often linked to repeated physical exercise at higher relative workloads. Soldiers need to know the relative workload, especially for the endurance tasks. Relative workload is directly related to time to fatigue. The higher the relative workload, the sooner an individual will fatigue. For an endurance event, if a person is working at 50 to 70% relative workload of VO2 max, he or she will be able to continue this work for a prolonged period. If the relative workload is greater than 70%, an individual will not be able to continue this task for long, and the time needed to recover will increase. Since a higher relative workload may be associated with an increased potential for musculoskeletal injuries, leaders need to extend the soldier's rest recovery time after very high-intensity workouts. As soldiers train and increase their physiological capacities, their increased absolute workload will result in a lower relative workload. Nervous system. The nervous system consists of the brain and the spinal cord, the central nervous system, and the nerves branching from them, peripheral nervous system. The nervous system is the body's master system that governs the activities of all the other systems, including movement, thought, emotions, sensation, illness, and health. Through this system, the soldier senses and responds to the world. workload accumulates across the training day. If, for example, a soldier does squats in the morning and then stands all day in body armor as a range safety. If the soldier cannot recover properly from the acute training load, the squat, then the training load will accumulate and not be absorbed. The continued volume and intensity of the workload becomes chronic. This failure to properly progress the workload increases risk of underperformance and tissue damage. Central nervous system. The right and left halves of the brain, called hemispheres, are divided into lobes. The lobes form an integrated system that supports all conscious and unconscious functions. The following descriptions of each lobe impact these soldier functions. Frontal lobe contains the premotor cortex and motor cortex, which are the areas that plan and perform movements, and contains the Broca's area for speech production. Parietal lobe processes sensory information, sensory discrimination, and body orientation. Occipital lobe processes signals for visual reception and interpretation. Cerebellum coordinates a voluntary movement to include walking in a straight line. Brainstem controls breathing, digestion, heart control, blood vessel control, and alertness. Temporal lobe processes auditory reception, expressed behavior, receptive speech, and memory information retrieval. It contains Wernicke's area for speech comprehension. The size and anatomy of the adult brain is fully developed by age 26. However, this does not mean that learning ceases. When awake, people are constantly learning. The 12 pairs of peripheral nerves that branch directly from the brain but remain largely inside the skull are called cranial nerves. They innervate, such as supply with nerves, the muscles and sensory organs of the face and head. The sensory input that the cranial nerves transmit to the brain during daily activities and training become memory. Most of the information about these activities becomes short-term memory, stored for a few seconds to allow understanding of immediate or near-term events, and then discarded. A fair amount of information is stored as long-term memory. Storage is particularly efficient after sleeping for more than 6 hours the night after the event. These memories last for a few minutes or as far into the past as it is possible to remember, allowing the conscious recall of episodes and facts. Other memories, sometimes called skills, help with the repetition of tasks performed subconsciously, such as walking, eating, and driving. Fundamental physical training develops fundamental soldier skills: move, shoot, communicate, survive, and protect or treat, and the long-term memories to support them. Soldiers who have highly developed motor skills will have very extensive neural wiring in their brains related to those activities. In the well-trained soldier, particularly the ones who practice the fundamentals, the motions and continual decision-making needed to perform these combat functions happen without conscious awareness. Deep in the two lobes of the brain sits the limbic system. This collective term for the structures near the middle of the brain includes the hippocampus and amygdala. This connection allows the limbic system to impact the endocrine and autonomic motor systems. The limbic system may affect motivation and mood. The spinal cord is the other major anatomical part of the central nervous system. This thick bundle of nerve fibers connects the brain to the peripheral nerves. It originates in the brainstem and ends in the lumbar spine, protected by the vertebrae. Peripheral nervous system. At each level of the spine, smaller bundles of nerve fibers split off to form the peripheral nervous system. After leaving the spine, the peripheral nerves split and reform into major nerves, such as the median and radial nerve in the arms and the sciatic and femoral nerves in the legs. The peripheral nerves branch into progressively smaller bundles until a single nerve fiber meets with the part of the body it innervates. If the nerve supplies a muscle cell, it is a motor neuron. When the nerve ending meets the muscle, the connection or synapse is called a neuromuscular junction, known as an NMJ. The types and size of the chemical reactions that occur at the junction drive the amount of force the muscle can generate. The peripheral nerves originating in the neck, cervical spine, supply sensation and muscle control to the shoulders, arms, and hands. The largest of these upper extremity nerves are the median, radial, and ulnar nerves. The nerves that supply sensation and muscle control to the legs originate in the lower back. The sciatic nerves pass behind the buttocks and backs of the thighs before dividing to innervate parts of the calf and foot. The femoral nerve courses through the front of the hip and innervates the quadriceps muscle on the front of the thigh. Motor neurons regulate how much force is generated by each muscle fiber. If the motor neuron is severed, the signal from the brain cannot travel along the motor neuron to the muscle. No force will be generated. The muscle is said to be paralyzed. Any interruption of the signal along the nerve's path from the brain to the muscle due to injury, fatigue, or lack of training will impact the amount of force generated. If the nerve is intact, signals can be sent at increasing speeds to excite the muscle fibers innervated by that nerve. Faster signaling causes more frequent muscle fiber contraction and more force to be generated. Some motor neurons innervate more muscle fibers than others. Those motor neurons involved in large movements or gross motor patterns may innervate a dozen muscle fibers. If a muscle produces complex, small movements or fine motor patterns, its motor neurons may contact several hundred fibers. Neuroendocrine system. The neuroendocrine system coordinates the response to exercise across multiple organs and hormone systems. The neuro part of this system is the autonomic nervous system. The endocrine part is the collective name for glands that can release hormones into the bloodstream. Hormones are chemicals that can alter the way an organ functions. For example, the body releases epinephrine, adrenaline that affects the heart, and norepinephrine affects the blood vessels in response to physical stress. Like the peripheral nervous system, the autonomic nervous system also lies outside the central nervous system. As its name suggests, the autonomic system functions without conscious input to stimulate and control the muscle tissue in the heart, organs, glands, and blood vessels. It therefore impacts the respiratory system, lungs, cardiovascular system, the heart, blood vessels, and blood, and organs, kidneys, liver, and stomach, endocrine system, and lymphatic system. The autonomic system has two parts, the sympathetic and parasympathetic systems. The sympathetic system stimulates cardiac muscle to increase heart rate, whereas the parasympathetic slows it down. Both systems impact the same tissue at the same time to maintain homeostasis, but either can be turned up to cause a change in response. When the body reaches a resting state, the parasympathetic system is dominant. In this state, the soldier can better digest calories more efficiently, repair muscle tissue, and sleep. When the sympathetic nervous system is stimulated by increased activity or threat, physical and psychological stress, it reacts with the fight-or-flight response. The sympathetic nerves signal the adrenal gland to release epinephrine and norepinephrine, causing the arteries to the heart and muscles to dilate. The liver to secrete glucose and fatty acids into the blood for quick energy. The pupils to dilate. An increase in sweat to reduce a raised body temperature. Cardiorespiratory system. The cardiorespiratory system includes the heart, lungs, and blood vessels. This system takes oxygen from small air sacs in the lungs and delivers it through the blood to the muscles so that they can perform work. The amount of oxygen consumed or metabolized is a measure of how well the respiratory and cardiovascular systems are working during exercise, or how well they are trained. Oxygen is used in chemical reactions inside cells to produce energy. If oxygen is available, muscles can do more work. During prolonged exercise, the heart must pump more blood to supply and maintain the high levels of oxygen required by the working muscles. The frequency of heartbeats is referred to as the heart rate. The frequency of heartbeats at rest is called the resting heart rate, which is normally about 70 beats per minute, BPM. The resting heart rate for soldiers with high levels of physical readiness may be well below 70 BPM. Frequency of heartbeats during exercise is called exercise heart rate. The exercise heart rate can more than double in young adults during maximal effort, with a maximum approaching 200 BPM. The amount of blood pumped in liters per beat is the stroke volume, SV, and the cardiac output, Q, is the liters of blood pumped per minute. Q equals heart rate, 100 BPM, times SV, 0.1 liters per beat. Q can be as much as 25 to 30 liters of blood per minute in healthy young soldiers. As soldiers become better trained, exercise heart rate goes down and stroke volume goes up, which means soldiers can work at a higher rate or work longer at a constant rate with less effort. The soldiers are fitter. Their relative workload is less, and therefore the work is easier for them to perform. An example would be when a soldier finds it much easier to dig a foxhole after a period of training. Physiology. Balanced training has at its core an appreciation for how the human body works, its anatomy and physiology. Knowledge of these sciences supports training that is rational, scientific, and most effectively enhances physical performance while minimizing injury risk.